Episode 4, A Young Person's Guide to the American Political System, Part 2. Critical Thinking Question. Explain the difference between government and organized crime. Be sure to include in your explanation the disadvantages that organized crime syndicates might encounter by not having access to a 12-year propaganda system to convince impressionable young people that their activities do not constitute organized crime. Episode 4 of School Sucks Podcast, A Young Person's Guide to the American Political System, Part 2. Today's bumper music is not intended as a tribute to Michael Jackson, who I think I heard actually died recently. I think the media found a little bit of time to fit that story in between their hard-hitting investigative reporting and holding politicians' feet to the fire on various issues. Like I said, not a tribute to Michael, but More drawing attention to a warning that he gave us all in the early 80s about the perils associated with getting mixed up with people who will use force or aggression against others to get what they want. Really, something you want to stay away from. As Michael said, they will kick you, they'll beat you, they'll tell you it's fair. So don't get involved with them. Just walk away. Or beat it, as we used to say back in the golden age of the 1980s. Today's show is intended to tie up some of the loose ends that were left by episode 3. I'm really initially here trying to lay some groundwork about things that we're going to be talking about in the future. See, politics is not something that I want the show to be about. Politics and myths about the American political system are things that I want to get out of the way, so we can talk about some real solutions and really cut to the root of the problem of public education. So I feel that it's imperative to deal with these things initially. So if you are wondering where I get my information or you want to know a little bit more about why I think the way that I do, please visit schoolsucks.podomatic.com. The show notes offer a section at the bottom called Look Closer, where I include some additional reading and some of the reference material that I use to produce the arguments that I use in the show. I understand that a podcast of just a person spouting opinions, you could get that on the streets from a crazy person with a sandwich sign. So I do want to assure you that there is a lot of research and evidence behind the things that I'm presenting, and I do encourage you to go check out some of the additional materials that are on the webpage. See, my real goal with this show is to keep it short and punchy and to make the material digestible for a younger audience or for people who've never really had much interest in these issues before. But I do understand how that could appear to be like skipping stones across the surface of deeper concepts that I should be exploring in more detail. So if you are interested in exploring this topic in a slightly different way, I would also suggest another podcast that I appear on pretty regularly called Complete Liberty Podcast. You can find it on iTunes. The show Complete Liberty is hosted by Wes Bertrand, who is the author of the books The Psychology of Liberty and Complete Liberty, and it's usually a discussion between Wes and a co-host, but for the last couple months, there's actually been three of us, Wes, myself, and Daniel Lachemacher, who is an active duty conscientious objector in the United States Navy, and he runs the website warisimmoral.com. He also recently was interviewed by the Motorhome Diaries, and that video is available on YouTube, but do you really need to listen to him tell his story in his own words? It's really something. So check out the work of both of those gentlemen and listen to episodes 78, 79, and 80 of Complete Liberty, which are the first episodes you'll see when you visit the Complete Liberty podcast page. They feature a conversation between the three of us in perhaps a little bit more detail about the topics that I've been discussing on School Sucks during episodes 2, 3, and today. Now, the last show and this show both deal with the larger idea that I will not use the political process to deal with the issues of public education. I will not appeal to so-called political leaders for help. It's not really appealing. It's more like begging. This never solves anything. The government is not capable of solving problems. It is not incentivized to do so. But remember, too, this show is about striking the root more than just about pointing out the inefficiency of government. You know, there's a lot of people, maybe of a more conservative or libertarian, political libertarian ilk, who would say, you know, the government is really bad at doing good things.
Well, I would say that it's really good at doing bad things. Theft, violence, extortion, and perhaps most important of all, ways of manipulating thought and public opinion into a widespread belief that all of these things are somehow justifiable.
We don't want to use that system. We don't want to rely on those individuals to solve complex social, political, or economic problems that people just like them created, right? Because there's a certain psychology at play when it comes to the politician. These are people who think that they are smart enough or special enough to make decisions for the lives of other people and then impose those decisions on people who are total strangers that they don't care about with the use of force. Politics, my friends, is force. And one of the reasons why I do not advocate political solutions is because all political solutions require government action or involvement.
And you might say,
well, of course they do, if they're political solutions. When the government is involved in something, it is growing. The government can only become involved in something new by getting bigger, by becoming more expansive, and by prying further into more aspects of your life.
I also think it's worth saying that this is a show, as much as it is about education, it's also about complete individual liberty. And you might say, oh, liberty, I know that word. There's the Statue of Liberty, my country tis of thee, sweet land of liberty. It's a word that's been used a lot. But, like I said in the last show, it's very easy to convince somebody that they have liberty or that they have freedom if they're also misled about what those things actually are.
I know I talk in a lot of analogies and metaphors, but I think of freedom or liberty is like a nice, clear blue sky. The government is a cloud, right? We never go out on a nice day and we see that one ominous rain cloud off in the distance and say, oh, I wish that was bigger and closer. Government is antithetical to freedom. The government doesn't give you freedom. The government doesn't give you rights. It can only take them. Thus, the government versus liberty is very much like that clear blue sky versus rain clouds. The more you have of one, the less you have of the other. There's no way more of one gives you more of the other. That's what's important.
Now, some of the societies that we talked about in past podcasts, China under Mao, Soviet Russia, Nazi Germany, those situations are like typhoons, right? Like, you're going to drown. America isn't quite that bad, obviously, but we do have this big, ever-expanding, dark, ominous cloud. And people think that the size of that cloud can be controlled because of the political system that we have here, the systems that I talked about in the last podcast, the idea of democracy and the idea of representative government. This is an illusion. We need to be very clear about politics. So I'll say it again.
Politics is force. Politics is laws, opinions of certain people in power, written not even in English, but in this bizarre language called legalese, voted on by strangers who don't read it and then imposed on you. Political action, as a politician, is the outward projection of individual megalomania and narcissism. Political participation
is the outward projection of emotional discomfort and cognitive dissonance about the coercive nature of government. Because the people who are participating in this system, they implicitly, or perhaps even subconsciously, understand the real nature of government. They go and they vote, and they write letters, and they hold signs for the people that they want to see get elected, kind of as like their umbrella, right? They know what the government is. They know what the government does. They don't want to get rained on, but they always do. But you know what? I don't want to mix metaphors too much, because I'm supposed to be comparing the government to organized crime, like I said at the beginning of the show. So what is the difference between government and organized crime? I've heard the expression pretty frequently that the government is like the mafia with a flag. And I really don't think that it's fair to compare the mafia to the government, if you think about it. Sure, both organizations rely almost exclusively on force, the threat of force, or theft to maintain their operations. They both seize control over a territory and claim that territory and the people living in that territory to be under their dominion, because they are a very, very small group trying to control or exercise power over a huge mass of people. They will kick back little favors and, you know, little things for the neighborhood or whatever to lessen the chances of an insurrection by the larger group. They both offer protection services where they say, hey, if you give us some money, we'll make sure nothing bad happens to you. And if you don't give them the money, they make sure something bad does happen to you. But the government has, of course, flags, but it also has badges, its own legal system, an army, and a 12-year propaganda program that convinces children that it is not composed of people willing to use violence to get what they want. The mafia has to make do without any of those things. And it's also worth noting that in the 20th century, the existence of the mafia, along with every other form of organized crime, resulted, from what I can best estimate, between 750,000 and 1 million deaths. Governments, on the other hand, finished up the century with a tally of over 200 million deaths caused. And, holy crap, a lot of those deaths caused in the mafia and other forms of organized crime were related to government prohibitions on things like gambling, prostitution, drugs, alcohol, and other things that would be considered victimless crimes. So you could actually probably transfer a lot of those deaths from the organized crime column to the government column as far as root cause is concerned. So, you know what? Sorry if I offended anyone by implying that the two were exactly the same. And believe me, I understand that this line of argumentation is somewhat incendiary and somewhat radical to suggest that the government is like an organized crime organization. But I feel like other people are starting to notice this too. Here's a quick story from Fox News, which I obviously don't consider a reliable source of information, but this is kind of amusing.
Welcome back, everyone. You may remember this infamous line from the classic film, The Godfather.
Fredo, you're my older brother, and I love you. But don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again. Ever.
So is a similar mob mentality taking hold in Washington? Michael Francesi is a former mob boss in the Colombo crime family and the author of this brand new book, I'll Make You an Offer You Can't Refuse, How Washington and the Mob Are Acting Alike. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you.
So is this a big stretch to think that all of a sudden the Washington, D.C. has become our godfather?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I see a lot of similarities in the way they're operating and the way we used to operate on the street. And, you know, to me, it looks like that's the way it's going.
What do you mean? Extortion? Things like that?
No, I mean, just this desire to take control. You know, it's Geithner coming out now with wanting to exercise more control over business. It's the way we used to operate, you know.
The mob decide was all about 90% of your bonuses belong to him?
Exactly. You know, we would walk into a business and, you know, put our arms around the people, lend them a little money if they needed, and the whole object was to get control of the company, and I see this going the same way.
So let's talk a little bit more about Tim Geithner, because this plan, apparently, it's been leaked last night, but he's going to announce it today. You call him what?
He's like an underboss to me. I mean, he's doing the work of you know, the whole family, and he's kind of the guy out front and looking to exercise control. And to me, it's scary because this is how we used to take control of things. And you know, to me, I want less government intervention in my life.
Now, the unfortunate thing about this piece is that Fox News is only telling one side of the story. Fox News is a conservative organization, so while they are telling some pretty good truths about what the Obama administration has been up to, they're completely obscuring the activities of the Bush administration over the past 8 years. Because if the Obama administration is like La Cosa Nostra or the Italian mafia, as far as their involvement in business and extortion is concerned, the Bush administration was like MS-13, like shoot first and ask questions never. Hundreds of thousands of innocent people were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan because of their activities. So that part of the story is kind of important too, but to Fox's credit, they have been hitting a few home runs with investigative coverage over the Obama administration for the better part of 2009. And, you know, they really have no excuse to not be doing good investigative reporting. They've just had 8 years of sleep, basically, waking up only periodically to do public relations for George Bush and Dick Cheney. Before we move on, let's think of one more way that we can illustrate the government as force, as a violent organization. We're all aware of the fact that American automobile manufacturers, maybe with the exception of Ford, receive billions and billions and billions of dollars from the government as a bailout. Bailout because they had been paying their workers, a unionized workforce, five times probably what they were worth, and they had been sort of on the government's umbilical cord for the last 30 years. Same with a lot of financial institutions that we've also been hearing about in the news pretty frequently, like Citigroup. So imagine a totally free market where these groups get into trouble. Now, if we had a totally free market, like the automobile manufacturers never would have been in the trouble that they got into because they wouldn't have had a safety net to behave so irresponsibly. But imagine for whatever reason, hypothetically, that they did get into this problem. Now, they need to go door to door and raise $15 billion from people like you and me. So they knock on your door and they say, and this might sound kind of familiar, like our first episode, they say, hello, we are Chrysler, and boy, we've gotten ourselves into some trouble. So we were hoping that maybe you could just give us like $25 or $50 to bail us out. We behaved really irresponsibly. We've made terrible products for a long time. Our management practices have been abysmal, and we really need your help here. Well, most people would just shut the door. Like, I don't buy a Chrysler. I don't care about Chrysler. It doesn't affect me, right? But Chrysler wound up with $15 billion. Can you think of any way that a company could raise that much money from hardworking people without using violence or threatening violence? No, of course you can't. But they got the money. And how did they get it? The government. The government is force. It is violence. All of these people at Chrysler and GM and AIG and Citigroup and Bank of America, they say, thank God for the taxpayers. Those idiots will pay every time, no questions asked. I gotta tell you, people in the mafia must look at the government and say, man, if we only had our own school system, that could be us up there, hiding our blatant use of force to reward ourselves and our friends behind the illusion of legitimacy.
You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
The idea that politics is force applies to the people participating in the system as well. Because all they're really doing through voting is trying to get what they want imposed on people who want something else through political leaders or laws or programs. It is basically a war of all against all, which is which I laugh because Hobbes, the philosopher, suggested that government was required to prevent war of all against all. It actually creates it. And the people in political power benefit greatly from pitting different interest groups against each other. We see this all the time on the news. You're a Republican and you're a Democrat. Fight. You're black and you're white. Fight. You're gay and you're straight. Fight. For the war, against the war. Fight. For socialized medicine, against socialized medicine. Fight. Politics takes people who, in normal, polite, cooperative social interaction, would have absolutely no problem with each other, and it makes them enemies. Because if the two groups stay fighting with each other on various different interests, they never realize who their common enemy is. The people who are trying to control how they live their lives and take more and more and more of their freedom. That's the government. Those are the politicians. The people who point the finger at somebody else and say, no, 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 that's the bad guy. See, the government's tool belt is very sparse. The only tools that it has are theft and aggression. When you're participating in the political process, you're encouraging theft or aggression, regardless of which one of these groups, Republicans or Democrats, you support. They're both the same. They only have those two tools. Politics is like a skit that you're participating in, and both parties use the same theme, they use the same plot, they even use the same character archetypes. The plot, and you can really see this during election time, is impending doom if their party doesn't attain or retain power. A secondary element to the plot is change, right? Like, Barack Obama didn't invent the idea of change in elections. People have been saying this since the beginning of elections. Like, yeah, we know that the way the guy before did it sucks, right? But we actually know how to run this thing called government. It's like a battleship that's programmed with no kill switch, with no cutoff button, to just automatically sink anything that comes near it, right? There's no way to stop it. And politicians and their apologists just say, no, you just got to get the right captain in there. Now, back to our little skit. The theme is always authoritarianism. The Democrats use a more maternal authoritarianism, like, we'll provide things for you. The Republicans use a more paternal authoritarianism, we'll protect you. The archetypes are the same as well, even though they vary a little bit from party to party. There's the villain, which for the Democrats is big business, corporate America, the healthcare industry, big oil, these conglomerations or these cartels that the government itself created. And many were created actually during the administration of their greatest hero, Franklin Roosevelt. For the Republicans, the villain is Mexicans, Muslims, really Islamic terrorism. And their solution to the problem is the same tactics that created it. Imperialism, intervention, aggressive warfare, propping up dictatorships. If it wasn't so tragic, it would almost be comical. The helpless victim is always you, right? And the hero is a huge, unchecked, ever-expanding government run by their party. The two political parties in America, Republicans and Democrats, appear to be different things. Now, they target, most importantly, different groups to tell their lies to in order to get elected. That's primary. But they also appear to stand for different things and have different agendas. But the truth is, when it comes to freedom, both parties work in tandem against it. Both parties are glaring hypocrisies. The Republicans claim to stand for economic freedom, lower taxes, less business regulation, freer markets, which is kind of humorous. But the trade-off for that freedom would be that you need to live your life by a very rigid set of social standards. You can't choose what to put in and take out of your own body. They're very law and order oriented. They believe in throwing nonviolent people in jail for drug offenses. So you have one side freedom and one side oppression. The Democrats are the opposite. They believe in civil liberties, like being able to make your own choices about what you do with your body, what you put in your body, what you believe. But the trade-off is the tiptoe towards more control over the economy, higher taxes, more socialization and centralization over certain services. Now, when each group gets into power, something unfortunate always seems to happen. Despite all their wonderful platitudes about freedom, the only tool that they have at their disposal is force. So their agenda becomes getting more of the force side than the freedom side. So we just watched 8 years of George Bush, who did virtually nothing for economic freedom, but did so much in the way of the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act and the Defense Authorization Act against civil liberties. Now we have Barack Obama, who's not going to reverse the anti-civil liberties agenda of George Bush. He's going to ratchet up the economic oppression. And it just goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And this really explains precisely why the American people lost so much freedom during the 20th century and really beyond. The other thing that Obama will do that we can watch is he's not going to surrender power that George Bush consolidated for him, just like George Bush was not going to surrender power that Bill Clinton consolidated for him. All they ever do is figure out how to use that power that somebody else got for them to help their friends and punish their enemies. I heard one of the hosts of a radio talk program that I'm quite fond of, Free Talk Live, Sam Dodson, say one day, "Who's the worst president of all time? The current one. Because whoever that is has all of the power that all of the other presidents that came before him have taken, which makes him the most dangerous person to have ever held that office." And let's be crystal clear about something else. I think I should have accentuated this point a little bit better. The Republicans and Democrats only claim to stand for certain freedoms. They don't actually stand for them. Like, Republicans say that they're all about small government, right? But every time they're in power, the size of government grows. And one of the ways that they accomplish this is through deficit financing. Instead of actually raising people's taxes, they just transfer the cost to future generations through debt, to people who aren't even yet involved in the political process, who have no voice, who have no say. And when I say no say, I mean, voting, you have no say. It's kind of, it's a nice gesture, like a suggestion box on a plantation, but these are people who really have no say. Like, they haven't learned to talk yet, or haven't even been born yet, or haven't even been thought of yet. I don't know how somebody could look at that and not call it theft, but as we talked about before, and we'll talk about again, people are pretty good at rationalizations, especially when it comes to the party that they identify themselves with. Now, the Democrats, their agenda is really always about helping poor people, but so much of what they do only seems to hurt those people. Like I said, when the government does something, it has to grow. When government grows, it needs money to grow. That money has to come from somewhere, and they've been very good at making it look like it comes from rich fat cats. But one of the ways that government programs are funded is through the printing of money, which causes inflation, theft against us all. It's devaluing the money that we have in our pockets. That hurts poor people the most. So conservatives are always quick to point out how rich people pay the most in taxes, right? They pay the largest percentage of the taxes. But it's really middle class, lower middle class, and poor people who are hurt the most by any kind of government expansion, even when that expansion claims to be for their benefit. It never is. Like, if you think about a liberal program like welfare, welfare has been a fine way to quiet discontent among the most desperate people and the most likely people to mount an insurrection against the government. So it serves its purpose as far as the government is concerned. But it doesn't help poor people. It's not reducing poverty. It's subsidizing poverty. It's giving people an incentive to not only be poor, but to have more and more children in poverty. And allying yourself with one of these parties is the only way that you can be taken seriously if you're talking about politics. I think of a good example, and what really woke me up to the true reality of the political system in America was the campaign of a Republican in 2008 named Ron Paul. Now, what set Dr. Paul apart from every other candidate in either party was that he appeared to be articulating a relatively consistent position on liberty. Ron Paul was against the war in Iraq, but he was also for civil liberties, for drug legalization, for less government intervention in the economy. It was a shockingly consistent approach to American politics. The Republicans who shared the stage with Ron Paul during the debates claimed to be for small government out of one side of their mouth, but out of the other side, they cheerleaded a pointless war in Iraq that costs taxpayers about $5,000 every second. The Democrats, who claimed to be for civil liberties, were talking nothing about the legalization of marijuana or the repeal of the Patriot Act or anything like that. So it was only Ron Paul who stood out as somebody able to articulate a consistent political philosophy. Nobody else even came close. Therefore, it should have been clear that Ron Paul was not actually a member of either of these hypocritical, irrational political parties. But here's the strange thing. Ron Paul had to call himself a Republican. After 8 years of George Bush and Dick Cheney, he still had to call himself a Republican to be taken seriously. Like, come on, buddy, you can't fit yourself into one of these two irrational, hypocritical modes of thinking where both have a historical .000 batting average for providing effective solutions to social and economic problems that they also created. Are you nuts? So that really turned me off to the political system. I saw what a sham it was, what a paper-thin fiction this whole process is. It's just like this giant pageant that they were putting on to hide the fact that everything they do is based on violence. And everything they do is designed to benefit them or their friends and to punish their enemies. And this entire pageant seemed to be predicated on the idea that people are stupid. The politicians believe that these people were idiots, that they were this herd. And I don't believe people are stupid. But as I watch the conventions, the Democratic and Republican conventions, people seemed all too happy to play along. They just became these parrots, these robots who would chant things and wave signs, and they would cheer whenever Barack Obama said a word like change, or John McCain uttered a phrase like country first. I was astonished because what I was seeing was so many people who were willing participants in this continued assault on their freedom and this complete insult to their intelligence. And I think it was then, I mean, I knew before, but I think it was throughout 2008 that I really started to realize the full implications of the public education system in this country and its ability to reduce wonderful, creative, intelligent individuals into a predictable herd. A herd composed of individuals who don't even realize that they're individuals. They identify themselves as part of a group, part of a collective, waiting to be led. And it was incredibly saddening. And you know, this continues well beyond election season. I think of this healthcare debate that's been going on recently as another example. And the saddest thing is, for the people involved, with all their vitriolic verbal aggression and stone-throwing, they're not even really involved. They're not going to factor into the decision. Ultimately, even if it appears that their outrage is swaying the decision on a certain issue one way or another, the people who are in power are going to get what they want sooner or later, right? Like, they realize that if they're at A, and they want to get to Z, and they say, okay, here we are at A, we're going to Z. And the people say, bah, we don't want to go to Z, we like A. The political leaders will respond by saying, all right, well, how about if we go to B, and then we go to C, and then we go to D. And it's very gradual, and, you know, celebrities are adopting kids and dying of drug overdoses, so a lot of people really, through where the media tells them to look, aren't even paying attention to those more gradual steps from A to Z. People will not make the jump from one end of the alphabet to the other, but they will go gradually by sort of not paying attention. They've been well trained to not pay attention to politics. Politics and history and economics, those things are boring. Didn't you learn that in school? So it's kind of like the parable of the boiled frog, as it's called sometimes, right? Like, you can't throw a frog into a pot of boiling water because the frog knows that the water is hot and will jump out before it cooks. But if you put a frog in cold water and then gradually turn up the heat, supposedly you can boil the frog alive. That's the parable of the boiled frog. Getting people to gradually agree to go someplace that they don't want to go versus trying to take them there all at once, like they might do in more ostensibly totalitarian societies. So these people aren't even really participating in politics. They might slow things down and they might make inconveniences for the political leaders, but they're not really even involved. And this socialized medicine is a great example. The president of the United States, Barack Obama, was very clear, I think, initially about what he wanted to do with healthcare. He wanted socialized medicine in the United States. And if you go back and you listen to the things that he had said before he was president, or even before he was a senator, and all that's available, you'll see that, yeah, he was pretty much talking about an entirely socialized system of medicine like they have in France or Canada. But that was slowed down, especially by a lot of these people at town hall meetings who have this anti-Obama motivation where they're like, Obama is Hitler and Obama wants to kill old people, which I really don't think that that's Obama's agenda. And let me be very clear, I do not think Barack Obama is a good guy. He's a politician. When somebody says, I'm so-and-so and I'm running for such-and-such, you know most of what you need to know about them. But all that Obama has to do is get a law passed that guarantees health companies provide insurance to people with pre-existing conditions and creates a public option. The public option will appear to be free when insurance companies, private insurance companies, have to insure people with pre-existing conditions. Their premiums will go through the roof. And just like with education, how can something that costs money, that is going to start costing more and more money because of the government-imposed regulations and involvement, ever compete with something that has the illusion of being free? That's something that your taxes are paying for whether you use it or not, so you might as well use it. Which, incidentally, is not the right attitude. But it's the attitude that a lot of people will have. Now, what are employers going to do? Employers who offer health insurance to all of their employees, when they have the option of ever-increasing private health insurance companies versus a government program that they have to pay for anyway. So the debate that's being held in the public arena is not even about what it should be about. The first thing it should be about is, why does healthcare cost so much? And the answer is, well, the force of the government made it that way. See, there was another healthcare crisis that no one really talks about, and it was sort of spearheaded by the AMA, the American Medical Association, earlier in the 20th century, where their crisis was that there was too much variety and competition in the healthcare industry, and thus their doctors couldn't charge monopoly rates for services. And there was midwives and all these other options that people could use for healthcare. So the AMA said, boy, what if we use the force of the government to create all these regulations and stricter standards so we basically run the show? That's the outcome. And we've seen healthcare costs go up and up and up and up and up since then. That's one part of the discussion that no one's having. The other part is this guaranteed issue thing. No one's talking about guaranteed issue. They're drawing Hitler mustaches in Obama and saying that he wants to kill old people. So this was a stupid debate being held by people who aren't even really involved in it. Because guaranteed issue is going to happen. The public option is going to happen. That's A to B. We're going to Z. Z is complete government control over healthcare in America. Here is Barack Obama in June of this year.
Let me also address a illegitimate concern that's being put forward by those who are claiming that a public option is somehow a Trojan horse for a single-payer system.
Now, that single-payer system is A to Z. And actually, you know, I've been using A to Z to demonstrate going from one place to another. But as far as the socialization over America's health care is concerned, right now, if A is like a free market system, right now we're somewhere past LMNOP and moving towards Z. But this speech that Obama's giving that you just heard was after concerns had been raised about the true agenda of the system. And Obama said, no, we're not going to Z, we're just going to B. It's just a quick little jump over to B. Here's Obama about 2.5 years ago This is March of 2007. This is obviously before Obama was president, so there were far fewer magnifying glasses on what his actual agenda was.
My commitment is to make sure that we've got universal health care for all Americans by the end of my first term as president. I would hope that we set up a system that allows those who can't go through their employer to access a federal system or a state pool of some sort.
And later on in that speech, Barry goes on to admitting the real trick of trying to take people from A to Z.
But I don't think we're going to be able to eliminate employer coverage immediately. There's going to be potentially some transition process. I can envision a decade out, or 15 years out, or 20 years out.
And here's Obama all the way back in 2003, before anybody knew who he was or cared about what he was saying, at the AFL-CIO.
I happen to be a proponent of a single-payer universal health care plan. A single-payer health care plan. Universal health care plan. That's what I'd like to see.
Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, Alexander Haig, once said, "Let them march all they want, as long as they pay their taxes." See, all of these people, with all of their signs and all of their yelling and all of these town hall meetings, to the politicians, it just looks like begging. It's still consent. They're still working within the system to try and change the system. In last week's episode, I suggested that the political leaders, the so-called political leaders in America, interpret your silence as approval. And I think I should amend that statement just a little bit. The way it really works is that they interpret your participation in the system as consent. And then in turn, they interpret that consent as approval. And they then interpret that approval as silence. As long as you're participating, as long as you're approving, and as long as you're consenting, the message that you send to them is the system itself doesn't need to change. And that's the problem.
I watched a lot of these town hall meetings, and I quickly grew tired of it because no one objecting to this universal health care or these health care reform issues could strike the root of the problem. Nobody stood up and said, "How about we make it as simple as this? Nobody has a right to anything at my expense, and I have a right to nothing at anybody else's expense." And I quickly grew very tired of waiting for somebody to realize this important moral premise that would stop people in government from doing so much of what they do. So after watching the town hall meetings for a while, I started to change the channels. This was about a week ago. And I came across an interesting special on the History Channel, a series they had been running called Gangland. The show was about gangs in inner city Los Angeles, specifically South Central Los Angeles and Compton, two neighborhoods that have been subject to the violent rule of two gangs for some time, the Bloods and the Crips. During part of the special, they showed a map of South Central and the surrounding areas based on territories that the Bloods controlled and the Crips controlled. The Crips were represented by blue and the Bloods were represented by red. And the thing that it made me think of almost immediately was that political map we always see of the United States, especially during election time, where it shows the red states and the blue states. Designed to distinguish places that vote Republican versus places that vote Democrat. Republicans are red, Democrats are blue. And what always astonishes me about that is a country that spans almost 3,000 miles from east to west and 1,500 miles from north to south, containing 300 million people. And there's only two choices. For the flavor of coercive rule they want to subject themselves to, which, as I hope we've illustrated here today, is not a real choice at all. The people in inner city Los Angeles have the same problem, but there's a key difference. In the special, when they went and they talked to people who lived in these neighborhoods, people who lived in Crip-controlled neighborhoods didn't fantasize about the advantages of living in a blood-controlled neighborhood or being subject to the rule, the violent, coercive rule of the Bloods. They just wanted gang violence, or violence period, out of their neighborhoods. The Crips had evolved, or perhaps devolved, out of another organization called the Black Panthers during the 60s and the 70s, with the sole purpose of combating what was once the common violent enemy of all the people in this area, the Los Angeles police. Unfortunately, the Crips chose the wrong means of accomplishing their goals. They chose violence, and the result of that choice is quite visible in South Central Los Angeles. I really look forward to the day when people in America will be able to see their situation as clearly as these people in South Central Los Angeles do. Violence always leads to the same place. It might look a little bit different. It might feel a little bit different. It might hide behind different rhetoric, symbols, or colors, but it's always the same. And choice between two organizations willing to use force and violence to get what they want for their gain at your expense is never a real choice.